The latest rescue at sea involving a refugee boat has focused attention on the role played by the Navy when it comes to asylum seekers. 162 passengers were transferred to HMAS Leeuwin and HMAS Wollongong after that distress call was made to the Australian Maritime Safety Authority on Wednesday morning. The SOS was issued while the vessel was still only 50 nautical miles from the Indonesian shoreline. According to the AFP Commissioner, Tony Negus, these calls for help are nothing new.
This is not a new phenomenon, but it just seems like the last few weeks we've had some very difficult sea states, we've had some very difficult situations that these boats have found themselves in, and we've had the results that we've all seen.
However, the growing number of distress calls being made well outside Australian territorial waters is a new development, according to some, and it's led to claims from within the ADF that the Navy is being used as, quote, a roadside service by people smugglers who know that Australian sailors will always respond when lives are at risk. Retired Admiral Chris Barry is a former Chief of the Defence Force. Back in 2001, he was head of the force during the Howard government's decision to launch Operation Relics, which involved turning back the boats in the wake of the Tampa affair. Chris Barry joins us now. Chris, welcome back to breakfast.
Good morning, Fran.
Chris Barry, people smugglers are increasingly savvy. We know that. And we also know, or pretty sure anyway, they're instructing their crews to issue distress calls now to the Australian authorities, even when they're still quite close and to Indonesia, much closer to Indonesia than Australia. Is this a surprising tactic in your view?
No, I don't think so. I think there are a number of elements at play here. First of all, I've just recently returned from Europe, and there are many people who see Australia as a very, very attractive place to come to in today's connected world. And secondly, of course, what these people are really making clear, I think, to us in Australia and elsewhere is that this is the place they want to come to. They don't want to go to any other place. And that's one of the reasons why these tactics have shifted over recent months.
Okay, so more and more boats have been coming in the last 2 months in particular. What legal obligation does Australia have to dispatch naval assets to help out these boats if they are outside Australian territorial waters and there are no Australian ships, naval or merchant nearby?
Well, I think there are two elements to that, apart from any humanitarian aspects. And one is, of course, the obligation under the SOLAS Conventions. And that relates to how mariners behave when they find fellow mariners in distress. Mm-hmm. And the second part of it is, of course, the worldwide search and rescue organisations, in which we have a particular responsibility, having huge territorial and contiguous zones around Australia for providing maritime search and rescue, for example, what we did down in the South Seas for Tony Bullimore and that like. So I think those two things are our international obligations, and that is apart from any of the humanitarian things.
I want to get to what you think about the way it's being performed at the moment and the changes Tony Abbott's talking about, but just in terms of this work for sailors, I mean, I guess it's not the type of work a young person enlists in the Navy to do, and we've heard stories recently, and obviously the sailors who were involved in the rescue of those people and also the recovery of the 90 bodies at that maritime disaster 2 weeks ago has led to post-traumatic stress disorder. Is that a major problem for sailors when they're involved in this kind of work?
Well, I think it's always going to be a factor. I mean, on one hand, if you find a boat with people on it and they're all well, that's one set of situations. But we are finding more and more, I think, boats where the plight of the people on board really does test your sense of compassion and humanity. And I think that's where, on one hand, our state of training, I mean, our people are very professional, very well trained, have done a fantastic job, but it nonetheless does attack their sense of humanity, and they must wonder to themselves, what are we doing here? What's going on? Why is this necessary? And so I'm not surprised that there'll be some affected with post-traumatic stress syndrome.
And as a former head of Navy and a former CDF, have you spoken to sailors who have talked to you about this? What are we doing here? And how do they? What do they say to you about how they feel about this work?
Well, the stories I hear are one of, you know, these can be very challenging tasks, but nonetheless, you know, we've accomplished them to the best of our ability. Our professional standards are high. We know we do a good job. But nonetheless, we still feel sorry for a lot of these people, especially when it goes wrong and some of them are killed.
Do you think the Navy does enough to offer support services to traumatised crews?
Yes, I think the Navy does a fantastic job of it. You know, last year I went to a gathering in Sydney with some of the people that came in 2001. And to a person, they were all very much in admiration for the job the Navy had done in those days. In fact, one woman who runs a radio station had said to me, an Arabic radio station, why can't I get somebody from Navy to come and try to convince our youngsters to join the Navy? So I think that sort of reputation is out there. It is a highly professionalised force. It does a fantastic job. And they know that once they get into the hands of the Navy, they'll be well looked after.
Some of those people who arrived in 2001 arrived on the Tampa, and the captain of that ship, Arnie Rennan, you know, was insisting on fulfilling his duty under the international treaties of saving lives at sea. You were the chief of the Defence Force at the time when the Howard government, in the wake of the Tampa, ordered the Navy to turn back boats. It's a policy called Operation Relics, and it's a policy that the current coalition would like to revive should it win government. Tony Abbott has given a little more detail how he thinks that could be achieved. Let's listen to Tony Abbott.
The naval personnel would board boats, they would ensure that they were seaworthy, they would remove fuel from the vessels so that the only option for those vessels was to return to Indonesia.
That's Tony Abbott speaking yesterday. Chris Barry, that's what the Navy would be asked to do under a coalition government, board boats, see if they're seaworthy, take fuel from the vessel to make sure there's only enough to get back to Indonesia. Tony Abbott says it worked in 2001. Do you think it will work again, and is it a good idea?
Well, I do worry about the idea that this will work because, and I noticed that the statement was qualified. Look, what happened in 2001 was that boats who came to Australia in many cases were not seaworthy. They had to be fixed up to make them seaworthy. The engines of the boats were destroyed. They were destroyed so they couldn't move and they had to be fixed. And the issue of having just enough fuel to get to land was also there. So putting all that together, what it tells me is that people smugglers are briefing these boats to make sure that they are unseaworthy, they're not able to work when they get anywhere near Australia. We've seen already examples of boats being set on fire and other accidents. The problem about the policy is it drives people to very desperate measures, and I don't think that is something that we should promote.
If you were naval commander now, or if you were head of the CDF now, and a government raised this policy with you, given what you know, what would your advice be?
Well, I would say my expectation wouldn't be very high. It's going to work in many cases. And I would be very conscious that our commanding officers at sea must act in accordance with international law and balance off the requirements to act in accordance with the SOLAS conventions on one hand, and any orders that we've given them on the other.
Well, Tony Abbott makes that point under his policy. He says naval commanders on the spot would have the option of turning boats around if it was safe to do so, but then he made those comments we just heard. Under Operation Relics, when you're in charge, when the Howard government was in place, who ultimately decided whether a vessel was to be turned back? Was it the commander at the scene? Or, as I understand it at the time, I thought there were instructions to ring back to base in sense and get government approval and guidance for what to do?
I think ultimately all those decisions were in the hands of the commanding officers at sea. Of course, there was an interaction between them and the shore authorities over the detailed administration of the situation, because when I say the engines had to be fixed, we had to fly teams of experts up to those boats in order to fix the engines before we could take them back. So it wasn't as though it was a split-second decision. In some cases, it took us weeks to fix boats, to put them in a condition that could allow them to be taken back. Now, they're the issues, I think, that will come to the fore. But ultimately, it will be in the hands of the commanding officer at sea to make that decision.
And so you weren't under instruction back then to ultimately then get any kind of instruction from Cabinet?
I think the word would be try. Here is a general principle of what we'd like to achieve. We will try to do it. Of course, there are pressures to make it work. But ultimately, that decision still rests at sea.
Chris Barry, thank you very much for joining us on Breakfast.
Okay, thanks, Fran.
Retired Admiral Chris Barry, he was the head of the Australian Navy and the head of the, he was the chief of the Defence Force generally when John Howard was in government and put in place the Pacific Solution, which included the naval exercise of turning back the boats under Operation Relics.